This podcast contains adult language and stories of true crime. If you don't like laughing, crying, or being horrified at the actions of other humans, this podcast is not for you.
Welcome to Season 3, Episode 17 of the show Resolved Mysteries. We are so happy that you're here. We've got a giddy episode for you today. Mm-hmm. If you are new, this is the show where we rewatch, recap, and give you the latest updates to cases featured on the show Unsolved Mysteries, which you can watch pretty much everywhere these days. Mm-hmm. I'm Eliza.
I'm Allison.
I'm Carlin.
And we're happy you're here. As I've said, we're so happy you're here,
we're
apparently.
Just bursting
times
at the seams.
A million. Even though, truly, we're recording this and no one's here. And that's the saddest part of all. Will anyone listen? Will anyone even listen? All right. As many of you know, for every review we receive, we donate $1 to a different organization. And it is a new month, so we have a new organization. This month's is called GEMS, G-E-M-S, and it stands for Girls Educational and Mentoring Services. They say, for the past 20 years, GEMS has served as the nation's leading organization for empowering commercially, sexually exploited, and domestically trafficked girls and young women. Through cultural change, advocacy, training, and survivor leadership, GEMS is committed to shifting public perception and policy. And that was suggested by our patron, Thomas G. So thank you so much, Thomas.
Thank you,
that
Thomas.
Sounds like a great organization. We're happy to help them.
Yes.
And you can help us help them by leaving us a review. And if you'd like to support us on Patreon and be able to, like Thomas did, suggest to us an organization you'd like our review dollars to go to, along with a lot of other great things, you can go to patreon.com/resolvedmysteriespodcast. You'll get access to ad-free episodes, 2 additional episodes a month, early access to listener short stacks, and goodies in the mail. Okay, we've got a 4-parter this episode.
Ooh-wee.
Allison, what are you covering?
I am covering the unexplained death of Tracy Kirkpatrick.
And I have a wanted segment, a true dick bitch, Steve Wilson.
And I have a lost loves about Frankie Bloomer.
The cutest name.
I know.
And then I wrap it up with a missing segment, and it is the story of Judy Himes.
All right.
Let's go.
Let's do it. Okay, so our first segment is an unexplained death segment, and it is the murder of Tracy Kirkpatrick. So Stack begins by telling us that Tracy Kirkpatrick was an introspective, pretty teenager living in a small town near Frederick, Maryland. The third of 4 children, which included her sisters Angie, Dayanda, and her brother Jack. While Tracy was born in East Liverpool, Ohio, the family would later relocate to the Point of Rocks, Maryland. Tracy was an honor student who loved reading and writing poetry. Those who knew Tracy described her as being both funny and smart with a feisty attitude.
Love it.
She had a good, yeah, I know. She had a good sense of humor with a love for people, and her friends recall her constantly blasting the radio in her 10-year-old Pontiac Grand Prix.
Yes, girl.
Queen.
Which she bought with her own money.
Queen.
Queen.
Tracy also had a more reserved side to her and was known for being quiet and shy. She was an introspective young woman who liked her independence and was known for not allowing her picture to be taken.
Hmm.
She was also apparently very compassionate, a trait which extended not just to her loved ones, but to animals as well.
Hmm.
She would often take in strays from around the neighborhood, not wanting to leave them out on their own.
Hmm.
I read a quote from her mother, Diane, and she said, quote, "She loved animals. She would pick up every stray she could find. We must have had 30 cats running around the house at one point." That sounds like someone I know.
This is sounding really familiar.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Diane goes on to say, "We had dogs, rabbits, everything. If a bird fell out of a tree, she'd want to take it home and nurse it back to health.
Honey, Eliza. Honey.
Oh, Kendra, Allison doesn't even know the horrendous bird story yet. She doesn't even know.
Eliza just saved a bird's life recently.
Bird?
Oh, girl, it is too graphic for the podcast, honestly. We cannot.
Okay, scoop me later.
I'll scoop you later.
Okay. So, she says, if a bird fell out of a tree, she'd want to take it home and nurse it back to health. Of course, I would give in to her. I always gave in to her. But she was just like that. She was very kind-hearted. At 17 years old, Tracy was in her final year at Brunswick High School. She was an honor student with a GPA between 3.5 and 4.0. She had an interest in writing and poetry, and she often expressed her feelings through her work. The majority of her poems spoke about loneliness, and one was actually published in the New American Poetry Anthology.
Mm-hmm.
Given her dedication to her schoolwork, it came as no surprise to those who knew her that she had her whole life planned out. Upon graduating, she was set to attend St. Mary's University to study accounting with the hope of later getting accepted into law school. They are showing, while they're saying all of this, so some of that came from my readings, different articles, and some of that's from UM. But they're showing photos of her, and she has the best smile. Aww. It's like a 1,000-watt smile. She is such a sweetie. Aww. So Stack says that in early 1989, Tracy read her family a haunting poem by poet Christine Rossetti. Stack says that Tracy seemed to be asking them not to grieve for her when she is gone. The poem is called Remember, and it's not that long, so it goes, remember me when I am gone away, gone far away into the silent land. When you can no more hold me by the hand, nor I half turn to you, yet turning stay, remember me when no more day by day. You tell me of our future that you planned, only remember me, you understand. It will be late to counsel then or pray, yet if you should forget me for a while, and afterwards, remember, do not grieve. For if the darkness and corruption leave a vestige of the thoughts that I once had, better by far you should forget and smile than you should remember and be sad.
Hmm.
So Remember was written by Christina Rossetti, who lived from 1830 to 1894. She was only a teenager when she wrote the poem, and it's essentially a classic Victorian poem about mourning and remembrance.
Hmm.
It was written in 1849, but not published until 1862, when it appeared in Rossetti's first poetry volume, Goblin Market and Other Poems.
Oh, love the name.
Me too. So Diane Kirkpatrick, Tracy's mother, is interviewed, and she says that Tracy and her boyfriend had just broken up and that she thinks she expressed her feelings through her writing. I also read that Tracy and her boyfriend had decided to get back together the night before she was murdered.
Wow.
Ugh.
Diane is such a sweetie, and she has the chef's kiss, tightest lady mullet I have ever seen.
Oh.
It is so on point.
Honey, I forgot.
It is clipped. Oh, it's so
it
good.
It is tight.
I mean, it's the best one that I've seen so far.
Yes, I know. Wow, I know for a fact that it's been featured on the Unsolved Mullets Instagram.
Oh, I love it.
Oh, of course.
It's like a shining star of it, honestly.
Oh, yeah. It's a beacon of mullethood.
Yes.
So Diane says that Tracy wrote a lot of lonely poems, but that could also be her age, because teenage girls are pretty angsty generally.
Mm-hmm.
Diane says that Tracy was very intelligent and a hard worker, and she loved people, and she loved to have a lot of friends. Stack says that during Tracy's senior year in high school, she held down two part-time jobs. So one of them was at a sales clerk in a women's clothing store. The store, so I'm going to be interjecting some additional information as I go, so I'm not rehashing all of this.
Yeah.
The store was called Aileen's Women's Sportswear in the West Ridge Shopping Center. And then the other job she worked at was at Barnett Shoes, which was actually located next door to Aileen.
Mm.
Also, I remember that, like, when they're in the reenactment and they're in the sportswear store, it's clothing, but then against the back wall, it looks like they're selling, like, ceramic tchotchkes. Like, I don't know who did the
set design. The,
like, prop. Yeah, I don't know who did the set design, but I don't know what the hell they're selling in that store.
It's a little overspill from one of the other episodes.
It's, like, sportswear and ceramic unicorns. Like, so on the night of March 15th, 1989... Tracy was assigned to close the store and tally up the day's receipts. I later read that it was her first solo closing shift, so she had never done it before.
Ugh.
At around 6 p.m., Diane stopped by the store to bring Tracy some dinner, and she found her alone reading a book. The pair chatted for a bit, with Tracy telling her mother that she planned to head straight to bed upon getting home later that night. 2 hours later, at around 8 p.m., Tracy's manager stopped by the store for a few minutes. It's been noted that the store's cash register did not record any sales after this time, and Tracy was again alone in the store from then onward. At 8:45 p.m., Tracy was alone in the store. 2 hours later, a shopping mall security guard noticed that the lights inside the clothing store were still on. The front door was unlocked, and the guard called out but received no response. He walked toward the back of the store and found Tracy's body in a storage room. He called the police. I read later some additional information about the security guard. So when closing time came around at 9 p.m., a security guard named Don Barnes, Jr., who also worked as a sheriff's deputy for Frederick County, claimed that he noticed the store's lights were still on. However, he said it didn't strike him as odd, as he assumed the cashier on duty was most likely still prepping it for closing. He then claimed he began to grow concerned when at 10:30 p.m. he circled around again and noticed the lights were still on and the front door was unlocked. He said that he called out, received no response, continued into the store to investigate, and that's where he came upon Tracy's body in the back storeroom, and she had been stabbed several times in the chest and back. Almost simultaneously, her parents were on their way to the mall to check on Tracy, because it was now 11 p.m. and they were worried. Deonda, Tracy's sister, later said, quote, "We weren't even allowed to date until we were 18. Tracy had just gotten her license, and most school nights she had to come right home from work because she got off at 9 p.m., and she usually got home around 9:30. Her car battery was dying, and Dad had to go jump her car the night before, so he thought the reason she hadn't gotten home yet was because the car broke down." What a nightmare. So Diane says as soon as she saw the police cars at the store, she jumped out of the car and ran toward the storefront. At first, the law enforcement officials didn't want to let her in, her and Tracy's dad in, because they didn't know who they were, but finally they relented. Diane asked if Tracy was all right and could she see her? And Diane says, quote, "And when he shook his head no, I just blocked out everything. I didn't want to hear the rest of what was going to be said to me."
No. I can only imagine, like, you go there thinking, like, everything's cool. She probably this, like, chill out. And then you see cop cars.
Yeah. I later read, too, that Diane was really worried, but her husband wasn't. He was Tracy's stepdad, but essentially had raised her. And he was telling her, like, it's okay, calm down, it's just her car. And Diane said that she knew something was wrong. And lo and behold.
God.
So I've read different accounts, but I read in an article that Tracy had been stabbed 22 times in multiple locations from her head and neck to her arms, back, and chest. God. Three separate stab wounds resulted in multiple fractures to Tracy's skull, while another two punctured vital internal organs in her right chest, including one in her lungs. Ugh. Tracy died of massive internal bleeding and trauma as a result of her injuries, according to an autopsy report released to the Frederick News Post. The wounds appear to have been inflicted by a single-edged weapon, but no knife or other weapon was ever recovered as a result of the investigation. Diane asks, who would do something like that? What did someone have against her? She never did anything to hurt anybody. Zach says police could find no apparent motive for Tracy's murder. There was no sign of sexual assault, and the cash was still in the store. As the door hadn't been forced open, and there was still money in the cash register, robbery was quickly ruled out, despite her purse being missing. Blood droplets were found in a rear hallway leading to the store's loading dock and trash bins. So, like, I don't know if you've ever worked in a mall, but basically there's these long corridors behind the stores, and that's, like, where everybody walks to get to, like, the back loading area and the trash bins and stuff.
Yeah, they're creepy. So, I never worked in a mall, but I had friends that did, and I was like, I can't. I mean, I did my own dangerous stuff, like closing a coffee shop at age of 15 and 16 alone, which is insane now, but those corridors are creepy.
Since there were no signs of a struggle and no defensive wounds, police theorized the murderer must have been someone that Tracy knew. A thorough analysis of the crime scene turned up latent fingerprints but no other physical evidence, and the case was stalled. Then 3 months later, police got their first real lead when a mysterious telephone call was recorded on a nationwide confession line in Las Vegas. So I'm going to play the call here.
Hello, Frederick, Maryland. I know this is going to sound surprising, but 3 months ago, I stabbed a girl to death. And you might think that in making this tape, I'm setting myself up to be caught. But there are a lot of guys named Don in Frederick. The girl I killed was working in a ladies' sportswear store. I often came by and talked to her when she was working alone. And one night when she was in the storeroom and we were talking, our conversation turned into an argument. And so I took out a knife that I had with me at all times, and I killed her. And a few days later, I realized that I had created a lot of sadness. And I thought about turning myself into the police. But whatever they do to me, that won't bring Tracy back. So I decided that I better keep free because we have the death penalty in Maryland. Thanks for listening. I'm sorry about what I did, but nothing can change it. Bye.
Wow. Yeah, I forgot about this. Okay.
Yeah. Horrible.
So this nationwide confession hotline that was based in Las Vegas gets this telephone call. The confession is super creepy and like very matter of fact.
Yeah. And it's almost like he's rationalizing it with himself.
I mean, he certainly is, right? He's like, well, I can't turn myself in. Maryland has the death penalty.
Yeah,
so
nothing can change it now. So
yeah. Too late. Like, so sad. Gross. So the hotline immediately notified the Frederick police. Detective Barry Horner of the Frederick Police Department says he believes that the call is real. He believes that the person has knowledge about the crime. Detective Horner took the tape to his chief, and the chief agreed that it sounded authentic as well. So Detective Horner says that they traced the call back to a supermarket in Walkersville, Maryland, which is 7 to 8 miles north of Frederick. Horner says that if it was the killer, he wanted to be caught and was seeking help through this hotline. The police department decided that Horner would write a letter to, quote, Don, asking him to come forward, and the letter ran in the October 10th, 1989 edition of the Frederick Post. The letter reads, Dear Don, 6 months now have passed since Tracy died. This has seemed like an eternity to Tracy's family and friends, to you and to me. The hurting never has lessened, and the aching continues. I have learned through my investigation much of what occurred on March 15th, but only you know all of what happened that night. I know from the June telephone call that you made in Las Vegas that the events of that night still haunt you and probably will until you share them with me. I discussed with State's Attorney Tommy Dorsey your concern about Tracy's death being a capital crime. However, Mr. Dorsey has advised me that based on the information I provided him, it is not a capital offense. This public commitment should remove your concern in this regard and encourage you to share with me the unfortunate events of that night. I personally am willing to work with you to resolve this tragic situation, and I pray you will come forward to relieve the hurt which Tracy's family and friends have suffered, as well as the pain which has consumed your life since that night. You and I both know we need to talk about Tracy's death, so you once again have peace of mind. Call me soon at, and then he gives the number. So, police received no response to the letter directly, but 2 weeks later, another unlikely phone call provided them with a new, quote, lead. On October 24th, 1989, Martha Woodworth, a Massachusetts woman and a self-proclaimed psychic, began to receive phone calls from a young man who called himself Sean. Sean seemed obsessed with finding the person who murdered Tracy. Martha told Sean that she needed more information before she could help, so he agreed to send her some newspaper clippings. Martha says that when she received the envelope with his handwriting on the outside, she thought that this person had a much stronger involvement than just being a friend who's interested. She says she found the handwriting extremely disturbed, so she felt it was her responsibility to alert the police that she had a potential suspect for them.
Is she a handwriting expert?
No. And if you look at my handwriting, I look like a crazy person.
Patrons, you know.
Patrons, you know, that is my handwriting on those envelopes. It is deep. I have terrible handwriting.
No, you don't.
I don't need a psychic calling me a crazy person. Also, anytime a psychic injects themselves into a case like this,
yeah.
It's like, okay.
Yeah.
So the chief of police, Richard Aston, played the recording for Martha. And Martha claims that she recognized the man's confession as matching Sean's voice, the man who was making the phone calls. So Chief Aston encouraged Martha to maintain contact with Sean. So police checked out the return address on Sean's envelope. And it was in Walkersville, Maryland, the same location where the confession call had come from. However, apparently the young man at the address, I love this, was not named either Sean or Don.
Oh.
Because people don't make up names when they call and talk about murdering people. Right. Like, they're definitely going to be like, here's my social security number. Yeah. Like, so at another dead end, the Frederick police turned to local radio stations for help. Again, this is a strange choice because you're probably going to get a lot more psychics and Sean's and Don's calling you. But I guess they must have felt like they had nothing to lose. And they were very frustrated by this case. So they played the call in the hopes that someone would recognize the caller's voice. After the tape aired, three people called claiming that they thought they recognized the caller's voice. Stack says, quote, again, the man was not named Sean or Don, but he was the young man who had lived at the return address. So maybe it's him and his name is not Sean or Don.
Like, yeah, can we get rid of that part?
Yeah, let's just put that aside and think critically. What are the chances that three people would have recognized the voice? And the guy's voice, at first I thought he was holding his nose.
Yeah, it's to, like, pretty distinctive, very nasally. Yeah,
it's very distinct. Yeah. And of course, this man isn't necessarily the man that killed her. He's just the man making these calls and sending these letters. Right. So police searched the letter writer / caller. They searched his home the next day. Detective Horner says that after the evidence was obtained from the suspect's home, after it was examined, they were unfortunately able to confirm that he was either at the crime scene that night or had any involvement in the murder. In the search, police found many news clippings about Tracy's murder, but could find no evidence that the young man knew Tracy personally. The suspect pleaded the Fifth Amendment and refused to answer any questions. I need to learn a little about the Fifth Amendment. I guess he didn't have to answer the questions because they couldn't find any physical evidence that connected him to the actual murder?
Like, because they don't, you don't have to answer the questions.
You don't have to answer the questions unless they arrest you and then you ask for a lawyer. Is that how it works? I don't know. We need help.
Yeah.
I don't know. I always kind of thought either way you could choose not to speak.
We need our lawyer listeners.
Yeah.
So anyway, he pled the Fifth and didn't have to answer any questions. So Diane says that someone had to have seen something. Someone running from the store, hear something. She can't imagine something like that happening, and no one knows anything about it. Chief Aston says he isn't going to give up until they find out who murdered Tracy. Stack says that on March 20th, 1989, Tracy Kirkpatrick was buried in Oak Grove Cemetery near Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. The poem, Remember, was inscribed on her tombstone.
Yes.
Then the show tells us that the man who called himself Don and Sean was eventually cleared as a suspect and that the case remains open and unsolved.
Again, the man. Why do people do that?
What?
Call in and do a fake confession. Why?
I have a feeling that this guy had some mental illness.
Okay.
Like, I think he became fixated on the case, and I'll come back to, like, maybe what his motivation was.
Okay.
So police believe that he made up the name and do not consider him a suspect. So at this point, I didn't know what direction this was going in, but I immediately was suspicious of the security guard's story because how in the world? I mean, this is a strip mall. It's not very big. And he says he walked past at 9, saw the lights on, thought everything was okay. And then he says he didn't come back on his round until 10:30, or I've also read 11. So how in the world does it take you 1.5 to 2 hours to walk around the perimeter of a strip mall?
Yeah.
Like, it's not the Mall of America. I have pictures of it.
And also,
it's like a few storefronts.
Right.
Everybody gets into a routine of, like, closing time. Like, it's usually always the same time, like, unless something's going on.
Yeah.
So I feel like you would know if something was lasting even more than, like, 10 minutes, more than usual, you would know.
Yeah. So initially I was like, that doesn't really, I don't like that. That doesn't make any sense. And then, you know, keeping in mind that somebody she trusted, somebody that she would allow in the stock room, somebody that exited through the back that had to know the layout of the mall.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And then while I was watching the segment, I thought it sounded really familiar. The security guard discovering the body, being in a strip mall. And it turns out that this case has been covered a lot.
Okay.
So I originally heard about this case way, way back on True Crime Garage. Mm. I mean, they've been around for 4 years, and I think it was year one.
Okay.
Also, Going West, Trace Evidence have covered it. And then, of course, the unofficial fourth member of the Resolved Mysteries podcast, Robin Warder. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So there's so much out there about this case. Mm-hmm. And all of the sources will be in the episode notes. Okay, so incredibly, this case has never been solved.
No.
Bananas. So when doing research on this case, there's two different spellings for Tracy. There's with an E and without an E. So UM spelled it T-R-A-C-Y, but newspaper articles spelled it E-Y. And I thought it was super weird because it's not like you can't fact check it.
Yeah.
It turns out because Tracy was born with an E in her name, but she later dropped it and went by Tracy without an E. And her family spelled it on her gravestone the way they felt she would have wanted it. So, numerous mistakes, obviously, were made during the initial investigation. The first surrounds the doors to the back of the store, through which the murderer likely escaped. Investigators did not seize them and only examined them through the dim light of a flashlight. The second error involved the store's phone records, which were not subpoenaed before the phone company erased them. So, back then, you know, they would delete the data. It's not like there were no clouds that collected data.
Mm-hmm.
So, they didn't get around to it. A man who had been waiting in the front parking lot for his partner spoke with police and shared that he'd seen nothing out of the ordinary that night. To help bring in leads, local merchants put up a $5,000 reward for information. In 1998, a DNA sample from the case was submitted for testing. However, the amount was insufficient to develop a genetic profile of the killer, as was another sample submitted in 2003. In March 2009, investigators sent away, quote, touch DNA for testing to a private contractor with the Maryland State Police, and it's been reported that they have samples from two individuals who are currently suspects in the case. The case has been presented on two cold case review panels over the years, one nationally and another from the Mid-Atlantic region, in the hopes of reinvigorating the investigation. It was also taken to the ViDoc Society, which is a group of investigators who evaluate cold cases from across the world. Quote, the group says the case is definitely solvable, Sergeant Andrew Alcom says. Quote, they gave the previous detectives assigned to the case some tasks, if that's what you want to call them, to follow up with. The previous detective followed up on some of them, but he didn't get to all of them before he got moved, so we are still looking to follow up on some of the tasks they had recommended, as well as new advancements in technology and DNA. The Frederick Police Department is still actively investigating the case, which is amongst the most well-known in the city. They still continue to receive information, and the force's Criminal Investigations Division has a full filing cabinet and a couple of drawers devoted to all the files pertaining to the case. Recently, investigators have gone back and interviewed former detectives who previously worked on the case in the hopes of uncovering new clues, and they remain in regular contact with the Kirkpatrick family. According to the police department, each new detective who takes over the case becomes personally affected by it. They consult with predecessors, discuss any new developments, annually review the case, and consider any new ideas. Like I said, the department has resubmitted some evidence for DNA testing. Quote, we are looking at new waves of DNA testing and what is required for it, Alcorn says. There are limitations, the limitations of the testing. The case is 30 years old. A lot of the evidence has already been tested. We are starting to run into a situation where we don't want to test something unless we know we are going to get back the result we want. When I say that, I mean, we don't want to test something and then they come back and say, sorry, it's inconclusive. We want some type of resolution to this case, whether yes, this is the person or no, this is not the person. Mm-hmm. We want to be able to send something down to the lab and say, yes, this belongs to the person or no, it does not, 100% rather than, oh, it's inconclusive, because inconclusive doesn't really help us with the investigation at all. So there are three theories about the murder of Tracy Kirkpatrick. The primary theory is that the security guard, Don Barnes Jr., is responsible for Tracy's murder. According to his daughter, he was very abusive toward her and her mother, and as such, she believes he was involved in the killing.
Whoa.
His father was a former sheriff with Frederick County, which has led some to suggest that a potential cover-up has occurred. So at the time, his father was no longer sheriff, but was still very prominent in the community. I found his obituary and his memorial page, and he was a very prominent member of that community.
Okay.
So Don Barnes Jr. is now a private security contractor in D.C., and he's worked for the DEA and the Frederick County Sheriff's Department. His father, Don Barnes Sr., died in 2010, And I found a comment on Web Sleuths that said, quote, "It's well known that Corporal Horner was friends with Don Sr." So that's the man that was interviewed in the UM segment, the investigator. And then, I mean, the internet really seems to think that Don Barnes Jr. was involved. I don't know. His story is definitely dicey. Like I said, the strip mall was super small. He was also very, like, he was seen talking frequently to Tracy. Like, he was hanging around the store with her all of the time.
Yeah, it's not great.
Yeah. Maybe he found out, because her and her boyfriend had broken up but just gotten back together the night before. Mm-hmm. So it could have been a case of, like, he asked her out. She said she got back together with her boyfriend. And then the time, he basically gave himself an hour and a half when he said that he checked at 9 and then checked at 10:30. So a lot of people were like, well, where a murder like that, it's really messy. This person must have been covered in blood running from the scene of the crime. But if you escape through the back door, nobody would see you. And then you give yourself an hour and a half to clean up. Like, that's not that nuts.
Huh. Yeah.
So, like I said, around 2006, 2007, Don's daughter began contacting people on sitcoms online. She is convinced that her father did this. She claims that he was abusive and is all around a terrible person. I guess she reached out to one of the users on sitcoms online, a Dino guy, and he wrote about their conversations. So he says, quote, "Don's confession of the murder to the Las Vegas hotline was traced back to a payphone at a supermarket in Walkersville, Maryland. The guy claiming to be Sean, who became obsessed with finding Tracy's killer and began interacting with Martha Woodworth, the psychic, also lived in Walkersville. In her emails, Don's daughter told me that her father did live in Walkersville for a while and that he had a roommate named Sean."
Hmm.
"She thinks that Martha was mistaken about the voice, but she was close." And Dino Guy says, "The daughter told me she thinks Sean was too scared to go to the police himself. So his interaction with Martha Woodworth might have been another way for someone to get involved, helping Don get caught." That's another thing everyone online is saying is, what are the chances of Don knowing Tracy and finding her body and then the caller saying that his name is Don confessing?
Yeah.
True.
Right?
Yeah.
So Dino Guy said that he forwarded his correspondence with Barnes's daughter to the Frederick police, but he didn't know if they ever did anything with it. A person named Thomas on Unsolved.com provided some more credence to Don's guilt. Thomas said, "Don Barnes Jr. had a roommate at the time named Sean, which would give into Sean's obsession with the case and him saving newspaper clippings about it since he knew the actual killer. Sean knew he couldn't go to the police because of the sheriff's connection, so he sought other avenues. Don Barnes Jr. cannot account for the time." So not only did he say he went to check, he was on his rounds, but he can't actually account for any of that hour and a half.
Like, as what he was actually doing during that?
Yeah. At a later date, it was revealed by the daughter of Don Barnes Jr. that she believed he killed Tracy based on conversations she heard him have while she was growing up.
Oh.
She also said, during his unaccounted for hour and a half time lapse, that he went to his wife's house, whom he was separated from, to change into a new uniform, which would explain why there was no blood on his clothes.
What?
Barnes's daughter also says that Barnes was 25 at the time and separated and was into younger women.
Yeah. Which, if he went to the house to change, that would show that he didn't plan it.
Like, I mean, yeah, he's obviously involving other people. I don't think the murder was planned. I think it was a rage kill.
Right, and he heard about... Right, he heard about the breakup or that they were going to get back together. Yeah, and then she... yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know. And this person, Thomas, actually lives near the area called the Golden Mile in Frederick. It's like a shopping area. So he says, "I've been there many times. Don could have walked that whole strip close to 20 times within an hour and a half, which leads me to question why he didn't check on Tracy much earlier. Either he wasn't doing his job or he was up to something."
That's what I'm saying. Like, if he did this every night, they probably always wrapped around the same time. And if that didn't happen, he would have been like, "What's up? I'm going to check in.
What's going on?"
Yeah.
Totally. Thomas also says that Barnes moved to Egypt after the murders, and this was tossed around a lot. Barnes went to work in Egypt doing private security, so I don't know if he was actually on the run. It was also a bit later that he went to Egypt, and he eventually came back to the States, so I don't know about that one. Tracy Kirkpatrick was spotted several times throughout the night, and the only person who was constantly in the store was Barnes. How did he not notice anything? The shopping center then was not a busy place at that time, nor still is.
Hmm.
Tracy Kirkpatrick was stabbed in the back of the back room. There was no sign of struggle, so she must have known the assailant and was comfortable enough with him to leave the storefront to go into the back. I have to be honest, if Barnes did this, he's a total psycho because he is now in law enforcement. Like, he did private security in Egypt. He worked for the damn DEA. I mean, not only if he did this, he is, like, living large in the public eye.
What the
like,
fuck?
Amongst fellow law enforcement officials, which is what makes me think that he didn't do it because I have a difficult time believing that if you murdered somebody, you would then actively go into, like, upper echelons of law enforcement.
Right.
Like, the DEA, you know? The second theory is presented by retired Frederick Police Department Detective Bob Servicek, who worked on the case between 1992 and 1994. He alleges that an acquaintance of Tracy's was responsible for her death, saying he'd visited the store that night to tell her that he had feelings for her, but turned violent when she told him she wanted to remain friends. He said that based on circumstantial evidence, he believes more than enough evidence exists for an arrest and conviction. He believes a friend of the 17-year-old Brunswick High student killed her, so he believes it was a student. According to the detective, he had brought the case to a grand jury from which two-thirds voted to indict, but that the state's attorney's office had declined to prosecute the case. While Servicek claims that, quote, what derailed the process was politics and personal agendas, he says certain individuals did not do their jobs and derailed the case. For the reason that the acquaintance was never arrested, those involved in the case say that the indictment was not pursued because of circumstantial evidence. Several suspects were developed shortly after Tracy's death with different detectives who have taken over the case over the years, going back and forth between two individuals in particular. The family has their own opinion as well, but efforts to bring charges via a grand jury indictment failed when then-deputy state's attorney Julie Stevenson refused to proceed with the case. So Billy Kirkpatrick is Tracy's father, and he says, quote, she told us, I can get indictments on both of them with the information that we have. I can get an indictment on each of them, but it would end for each of them the same way. If we went to trial, a defense attorney will say, well, the other guy is there, and you can't prove he did it. If either suspect was brought in and later released due to insufficient evidence, prosecutors would not be able to bring charges against them a second time. So, to avoid a suspect being protected by double jeopardy, it's said they kept the case open in order to give future investigators the chance to obtain more evidence that would secure a conviction. That makes sense up until a certain point. This is decades. It was just the 35th anniversary. So how long are you going to wait for more people to discover evidence until you just take your chance and indict this person who is aging rapidly?
Yeah.
And bring him to trial, you know? Like, at what point do you give it a try and see what happens? Servicek took over the case in 1992 from retiring Corporal Barry Horner, who we see interviewed, and he was the first detective assigned to the investigation. While most investigators at the department have 12 to 14 cases to work on, the Kirkpatrick case was Servicek's sole responsibility for the year of 1994. Quote, 99.9% of my day was working on the Tracy Kirkpatrick case, Servicek said. It was probably the most sophisticated case I was associated with. While police still have two persons of interest, Servicek said he is convinced only one is the killer. He decided to retire in 1995, partially because of the Kirkpatrick case. He said, it was rough telling the Kirkpatricks he would be retiring. Quote, I felt like I let the Kirkpatricks down, Servicek said. I don't know of anyone who knows the case better than I do. So the final theory presented by Online Sleuths is that Tracy was a possible victim of the I-70 killer.
Whoa.
The unknown serial killer is suspected of killing six store clerks in the Midwestern United States from 1992 to potentially 1994, with suspected victims in Indiana, Texas, Missouri, and Kansas. Those who follow this story speculate that the I-70 killer was active prior to 1992. However, there is no evidence to suggest this. So I think it's a bit of a reach. Mm-hmm. She's in Maryland. She's not in the Midwest. Mm. And it's way before 1992. And we still don't know who the I-70 killer is anyway. So, what, you know.
Right.
So the Kirkpatricks remain in the Frederick area. They continue to keep Tracy's memory alive, holding regular vigils at the Westridge Shopping Center. Each year, they commemorate her birthday by bringing either yellow roses or carnations to a cherry tree they planted in her honor at Brunswick High School. Mm. Tracy is said to have liked the cherry trees that blossom in Washington, D.C. The family is still very much involved with the case. After the murder, Denise and Billy had to sell their home because it reminded them too much of Tracy. Denise would go on to quit her job because of the stress. And in 2009, I read an article and she was interviewed and she said she doesn't leave the house.
Oh.
She's basically a shut-in. Oh. She only leaves the house when her children take her out. Deonda has sort of taken over the role of Denise in this crusade. She's the one that now deals with the press and the media.
Mm-hmm.
A man named Paul Puglisi is currently working on a documentary called In the Silent Land, Who Killed Tracy Kirkpatrick? The family gave him permission to tell Tracy's story, and the film was set to be released in 2021. I emailed to see if they have a date yet, but they provided an update in October of 2020 that the pandemic had unfortunately slowed very important areas of production. The release was pushed back, and they don't know when they're going to be releasing
mm-hmm.
it. So Lieutenant Kirk Henneberry, who I believe is the person that's currently on this case, says, quote, "If we thought we had exhausted everything, we would have suspended the investigation, but it's still open at this point. And even though it happened 30 plus years ago, it's still very much an active case for us. We keep seeing cases all over the country where DNA has helped to solve all sorts of cold cases. The old-fashioned detective work with interviews and statements and analysis, that's all been done. So we're looking at any gaps in the case, things that were missed or overlooked. And a lot of that has been done. So now we're looking at technology and how that might be able to help us move the case forward." So those with information regarding the murder of Tracy Kirkpatrick are asked to contact the Frederick Police Department at 301-600-6219.
Wow.
That
yeah.
poor mom. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And again, like... just, it's just the time. Like, if it was today, there would be so many security cameras.
Mm-hmm. That's what everybody was saying. Everybody was saying that. And it was funny because people on the message boards were like, just pull the surveillance. And people were commenting back, there was no surveillance. Mm-hmm.
Some places just didn't have it yet.
Well, and there'd be like last text messages she had sent.
Yes.
Yeah. So she was on TikTok or Snapchat while she was closing.
Oh, yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And grab everybody's phone and look at their GPS coordinates and see who was where. And even the security guard. Oh, you said you were walking around the building? Okay, show me.
Yeah.
Give us your phone, you know? Yeah. I mean, it's just one of those cases. And also, I don't think that people would allow a 17-year-old girl to close a store by herself now, right? Isn't there like do they still do that?
I don't know.
Because they shouldn't.
I mean,
they shouldn't.
I was doing it. I guess it's almost been 20 years ago. So
I mean,
I think the laws are like you can work at 16. So it's just crazy. Up to the manager. Yeah. Like,
you know, it was interesting too that this was her first closing shift, the first time she was by herself. So who would have known that?
That is interesting. Because when you were talking about the I-70 killer, I was like, man, like, take your pick. Like, what storefront wasn't having a young teenager close down by themselves?
Yeah, totally.
You have, like, a buffet of victims.
Yeah.
But, like, with this, like, yeah, it's not like, oh, she closes every Thursday at this time. Like,
mm-hmm.
it was her first one.
Mm-hmm.
So either somebody knew that or it was luck of the draw.
Yeah.
If it wasn't the security guard, all of those things had to line up perfectly so it super looks like it was him, and that makes him tremendously unlucky. So. Pretty wild case.
It's one of those ones that feels like it should be so attainable, and it's just...
Yeah, I hope this documentary does come out because it does seem like, it feels like a Rhonda Hinson case or something where the information is definitely out there. You just need someone to suck it up and come forward.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully, fingers crossed.
Hi, I'm Ashley Smith. I live in Seattle and I'm the host of a new podcast called Washed Away. Come listen in as I work my way through the murky history of the Evergreen State and tell the stories behind Washington's most mysterious unsolved crimes. I do research, interview experts, and cover cases that you won't hear anywhere else. I do this with the hope that bringing some much-needed new life to cold cases might help solve them after all these years. But of course, that's only possible if all the answers haven't been washed away. Come find out at washedawaypodcast.com and subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you usually listen to podcasts.
right. So this is a wanted segment, and the man we want to rot is Steve Wilson. Oh, gosh. Okay. So we open on, first of all, we haven't gotten a lot of horse action in a while, and we are getting some, which I appreciate. So this segment is about Steve Wilson, but it's also about Callie Thornburg and her father, Bill Thornburg. And they worked together in the 80s on their ranch in Olancha, California. And at this time, Callie was 22 years old. And Steve Wilson came to the ranch and began working as a handyman. Stack says, quote, he took an immediate liking to Callie. So they dated for 9 months, and with her father Bill's blessing, Callie and Steve Wilson married in Reno, Nevada. Now, Callie comes on, and she's a talking head in this, and she is absolutely gorgeous.
Mm-hmm.
She's so beautiful.
Yeah, she is. She's gorgeous.
I love her beautiful face, and I love her beautiful skin. She's so beautiful.
She is.
I love to look at her. So she says that her father wanted her to get married so she would have something else in her life besides just him and the ranch. Mm. But that before she left to get married, she was wishing there was a way she could get out of it or not get married, but she didn't feel like that was possible.
Oh. Okay. That has to be the worst feeling.
Oh, yeah. Good.
Like, she clearly had feelings like it was not going to be good. And also, I think she was like, I don't need another life outside of this. I love doing this.
Yeah.
Also, I'm only 22 years old. Like, I'm fine. I'm totally guessing, but I feel like, you know, a rancher woman is not a super normal thing, especially then, but also always. And so the dad's probably just like, I just want you to have a normal life. But I think she didn't want a normal life.
Yeah.
So they get married, and the marriage is right away a complete disaster. Wilson is abusive and threatening to Callie. Like, really terrible. 2 months after the wedding, she leaves him and moves back in with her father on the ranch. And her father immediately realizes how terrible he is and, of course, takes her back. A few days after Callie moved back in to the ranch, she told her father that Wilson was making threatening phone calls to her. He claimed that he would hurt her and take everything she loved away from her and completely ruin her life.
God.
So then there's a reenactment of her actress riding a horse next to the man playing Bill, riding his horse, and he's just talking to her saying, like, I hate to say this, but I'm worried for your life and your safety, and I didn't realize how crazy he was. And she's like, Dad, I'm really scared, and it's just terrible.
He must have felt so terrible, too, that he pushed her into this, you know?
Yes, and, I don't know if he, like, Steve Wilson, I think, really ingratiated himself at first,
because
it seems like Bill was a really good guy and would have seen it and would not have wanted his daughter to be in that situation. So 3 weeks after the breakup, Wilson comes to the ranch, and we see this reenactment, and it is horrifying. He's trying to get Callie back, and this actor playing Wilson seems like he is on testosterone. He's literally shaking with anger. Like, he's so mad. He's literally, like, hopping. He cannot be still. It's gross. And I hate it. I had to watch it 3 times.
No.
So he's trying to talk to Callie. He and Bill, the dad, get into an argument, which escalated when Wilson grabs a crowbar out of the back of his truck and begins to smash Bill's truck.
Yeah.
So then Bill goes inside and grabs his shotgun and plans to shoot Wilson, but Callie stopped her dad from shooting him because she just didn't want there to be more violence, and she was afraid that if her dad missed, that Wilson would then just come and hurt her father. The gun did not deter Wilson or make him leave at all. So, you know, she's seeing, like, he's completely irrational. It doesn't matter that you have this gun. He's not, he doesn't care. So on May 29th, 1979, at 6 a.m., Bill left the ranch house to do his work in the morning, like he always did, but he never returned home. So later in the morning, Callie thinks this is unusual, and she goes to search for him, and she finds his morning coffee sitting on his truck, and his truck's still warm, but her father is nowhere around. And this is reenacted, and again, it's just so scary. Like, they're in brush, you know, ranch land. There's not anywhere for him to go.
Yeah.
He can't just disappear, and his car is still there. Mm. And she's, I think, at first thinking, I mean, she wants to find him, but when she's running all around looking for him and doesn't find him, and then days go by and he still doesn't come back, she's thinking Steve Wilson did it. But around that time, Steve Wilson also disappears. So 7 months later, on Christmas Eve, so she hasn't heard from her father all that time, he just vanishes, which is so sad. On Christmas Eve, a teenager was riding his dirt bike 45 miles from the ranch and found the skeletal remains of Bill Thornburg. And he knew his parents, I mean, he just thinks it's, he doesn't know who it is, it's just a skeleton. He knew his parents wouldn't believe him, so he takes the head and puts it in his backpack and rides back to his house to show them.
I know.
Honey.
It's
a crime scene.
I mean, then it was 79, it didn't matter. And like, they didn't say anything about it mattering, but now you just do not do that.
No.
Teach your children well.
Teach your children to not pick up heads.
Skulls where you find them.
So, right away, the police charge Wilson with Bill's murder, but Wilson is still nowhere to be seen. And he remained on the run until 1981, 2 years later, when he was finally arrested in Las Vegas. And the show didn't say this, but I read a few times that after, and he just fully confessed when he was arrested, and I read that after he confessed, he claimed that he also forced Bill to dig his own grave before shooting him execution style.
Oh my God.
Jesus.
So he pled guilty to murder and was sentenced to 25 years to life in Folsom Prison in California. Of course, it's a wanted segment. He's in prison. You think everything's fine. Oh, no. So Wilson immediately starts playing that model prisoner role, and he is quickly being super nice to all the guards. They're all really impressed with him because they've never seen anyone act before, especially a murderer, apparently. Like, the fact that they get fooled by this all the time, which is honestly, I was thinking about it, it's sad for the ones who are model prisoners. Like, for the ones who just are good people who either are in there for the because they didn't do anything and are wrongfully in there, or they made a mistake. Like, part of me is like, you shouldn't trust any of them because then you end up with what I'll tell you happens. But then also there are good people in there. So I don't know.
Well, I was going to say there should even be training against, like,
that's true.
If or somebody's like, acting like for a little too perfect, there might be a reason.
Yes.
That's on your family crest, Carlin.
Truly.
If someone's acting a little too perfect,
trust fucking no one.
Trust no bitch.
Especially the perfect one. So he quickly gets a job as a shipping clerk at the prison. And this is like the most coveted job because it has the least supervision of all the inmate jobs. And we see Officer Rick Martin come on, and he says in his 30 years in his career, Steve Wilson was the greatest clerk he ever had.
I was like, still honey,
giving him positive
laying
references.
Laying it on thick.
Like, First of all, I don't think that job is that hard. And second of all, don't give this guy any compliments, especially after what he's going to end up doing. It's so weird.
He's like, he's still the best.
But I still wish I could have him back. So the shipping clerk job allowed Steve Wilson to move freely throughout the prison without anyone wondering why he was or wasn't somewhere, because there are warehouses and like shipping areas all over, whereas other jobs are like, well, clearly you're just in the laundry room and that's it. You shouldn't be over across the campus.
Dinking dream. You just get to do whatever you want.
Dinking around. And oh my gosh, does he have that clipboard, honey?
He's got a license to dink, honey.
Okay, so in the reenactment, they show him checking on orders in the license plate factory, which I totally forgot. I remember my mind was blown when I learned that license plates are often made by inmates. What a weird society.
It's very strange.
So at 8:30 a.m. on August 3rd, 1984, while Steve Wilson with his clipboard's working at the loading dock, you know.
He's busy.
He puts a detailed escape plan into effect. And this is kind of a fun reenactment because they don't say how he's going to do it like they often have pre-said. They just show it to you, which is kind of fun. So all of a sudden, these two prisoners are driving forklifts and they just back right into each other. Oh no, you think, mistake, that's bad. Man, one of the guards really gets mad at them, runs over there. He literally says the quote, "I talked to you about this safety last week." This safety. I think this guard was improvising. I don't think he had any lines, or he majorly flubbed them.
He's like, it's fine. They're going to like put my audio behind the story anyway. It doesn't really matter what I'm saying. And UM's like, nope, full front and center.
Meanwhile, old Steve Wilson hands his clipboard off.
Oh.
Which, you know, it's serious then. And he sneaks into the back of the truck that was being loaded with boxes while the other prison guards are mad at the people who backed very lightly into each other with their forklifts. And there were several inmates in on this escape plan, and I'm always curious how that works. Like, what is in it for them to protect him? I'd be like, either take me with you or I'm telling on you.
I think that's how you end up dead in prison.
It's just so weird.
Take me with you or I'm telling.
Eliza in prison.
That's on my family crest.
Oh, God.
But seriously, this happens all the time where they just get other people in on it to cover
for
them.
You're right. There's often people who are involved in the plan but don't get to escape.
But they don't get to escape?
Yeah.
I think maybe when you're in prison, like, anything that will make a guard look bad, you're pretty much down for.
And, like, and it's probably boring. So that's
exciting.
It's
really boring.
Like, today I'm going to help someone escape. Great.
It's entertaining no matter what. Either someone escapes or someone gets caught. But either way, it breaks up the day, right?
Yeah,
oh, right? God, yeah. So shortly after him sneaking in and then he's able to hide behind some boxes, the truck was sealed and closed by officers and driven away. Then, once inside, he got some very sharp metal cutters that he stole from the prison, because he can dink wherever he wants to, and he just cuts a hole in the roof of the truck. And don't worry, the driver of the truck very quickly is going to stop at the bowling alley for a cup of coffee, which is just where you go to get coffee every morning, the bowling alley. Don't worry.
I noted that too. I was like, what?
And so sooner than he even expected, probably, he was able to jump right out and run away. It takes a while too for Stack to say, like, he pulls into the bowling alley and then he's like interjecting with how he cut the hole. And then the driver gets out for a cup of coffee. Like, I couldn't figure out. I thought he was delivering things to the bowling alley. I didn't realize he was going there for personal
coffee
beverage reasons.
Personal beverage reasons.
So then it gets very sad. Callie says, quote, having Wilson on the loose is very hard for me because I can never really relax. I don't like being alone, and I'm always looking around all the corners. I'm constantly in fear, which this guy is so crazy, and she's seen him be so violent. Yeah. Horrifying. She should have protection. So then that's kind of where the UM segment ends. And I'll follow up with a little bit of research. First of all, for unknown reasons, no pictures of the victim, Bill Thornburg, were shown, which was kind of unfortunate. But I found some great photos of him. Great ranchy photos. Aww. He's, like, very handsome. Yeah. So this is surprising that this was not included in UM. But apparently, a few months after his escape, Steve Wilson calls up at his home one of the prison guards and wishes him a Merry Christmas.
Says,
you will never find me.
Oh my.
And the prison spokesman who reported this to the newspaper said, he just said he was in the country to the north of us. That could mean anything from the foothills to the Canadian border. He also gave the guard a list of people he would like to pass on holiday salutations to.
Oh my God!
Such a troll.
He's making his list, checking his vibes. Yes. Oh,
so, I think that UM gave an update, but there's a lot more to it, so I'll just explain it here. This segment was also featured on America's Most Wanted. This is like the second time in a few episodes that we've had
America's we're seeing Most a lot more of that crossover too. Lately.
Yeah. So he was going by the name Glenn Moyer. And Glenn Moyer and his girlfriend, Lori Fitch, lived in a quiet Osceola County subdivision near St. Cloud, Florida, when he suddenly disappeared in February 1990. 2 days later, Fitch and her neighbors learned why. The television show America's Most Wanted broadcast a story about Stephen Leslie Wilson, who was a convicted murderer who had escaped from Folsom State Prison in 1984.
Ooh.
Suddenly, the whole neighborhood realizes that Moyer is actually Wilson.
Oh my God. Imagine.
I know. I always want to be one of those neighbors.
Oh my God. Dream.
I never want to be the girlfriend, though.
No.
Just you wait. Just you wait.
Oh, no.
So then, 7.5 years later, Wilson was arrested outside of London. And it is because girlfriend Lori Fitch stayed with him.
What? So,
apparently, back up a little bit, after his escape, Wilson moved to Oklahoma and then Austin, Texas, where he met Lori Fitch in 1984. Then they moved to Orlando and later St. Cloud, and that's where they had lived until he disappeared from her life in 1990. So also a little background on Wilson. He was apparently a former Air Force military policeman, a pilot, a scuba instructor. He had done all these things. He was also fluent in Spanish. Easily travelable, like a lot of them are.
This is like Bishop again. You're cut out for this almost.
Despite bragging that he would never be recaptured, authorities knew that he was still in contact with Lori Fitch 7.5 years after him escaping. And she didn't know he was a murderer. She found out, too, on the night that America's Most Wanted aired. But then somehow they got back in contact with each other. She said she still loved him. And so the FBI starts following her. Head of the FBI's Orlando office, Ed Bodegeimer, said, "We knew she was a contact and we've been watching her. It appeared that she was getting ready to make a move and getting ready to sell her house."
Wow.
So then Lori Fitch boarded a Continental Airlines flight from Orlando to London's Gatwick Airport. When the plane landed, she went to a hostel in Surrey and she met Wilson there. And as the couple left the building to go somewhere, Wilson was arrested by Scotland Yard.
Oh, damn.
Lori Fitch, honey. Wilson, who at this time was 47, attempted to flee, but he was arrested without getting hurt. And then he was extradited back to the United States, of course. They also interview the neighbors from this when they learned that who he was in 1990. And of course, he's just the nicest guy ever. Could be a murderer. You just can't believe it.
You never can.
Friends and neighbors in Florida knew him as Glenn Charles Moyer, a quiet, gentle man who was helpful to those in the community. Some of them said, he is such a nice man. He would always do anything he could to help anything. We're just stunned. This is unbelievable. Apparently, Wilson was also an expert builder, and he and Lori had built their home brick by brick with each other. He was the nicest guy you'd ever want to meet. He was never violent to anyone, and he always waved when you passed by the house. What he did must have been a crime of passion. That's another thing.
It wasn't a crime of passion, though. He continuously harassed these people.
Yeah. These are the Florida residents who, like, didn't know, you know, the whole story.
Yeah.
All right. So then he's caught, of course, and extradited back to the States. I can't find exactly what his sentencing was, but this is like 1997. And originally he was supposed to get 25 years. And then I read, obviously, they were going to add more time on for escaping. Mm-hmm. So then I'm like adding up the time and thinking, well, he should still be in jail. So I start looking him up, and I look up Stephen Leslie Wilson, and I find that he had a parole hearing on April 14th, 2020.
Whoa.
And I go through the table, and it says it's granted.
He's out?
So then, but then there's like no update to say when they're going to be released. So I do some more searching. And then finally, I just do the whole like California inmate search. And I searched for his inmate number. I searched his full name. And it said no inmate found. So I'm guessing he was released.
He's out. Whoa.
Which is so horrible for Callie. I feel so bad. Yeah.
So this guy went away, spent 7 years on the run, and then served less than 20 years in prison?
He served probably 23 years in prison because he was re-caught in 93.
Jeez. Wow. Yeah.
But I'm sure he showed that great behavior that he always shows.
I'm sure he did.
And that time, he was in San Quentin, it looks like.
Wow.
So I can't find him now. I really wanted to see if him and Lori Fitch were still together. Mm-hmm. I did find that I can't remember the year. Not long after he was recaptured, he applied to get married in prison, but that was denied. So I don't know if that was.
Yeah.
So just one more thing back to the real important people of this story. I was able to find Callie Thornburg on Facebook. Her Facebook is full of horse pictures. She's still living that ranch life, which is like so beautiful. Isn't that so nice? Like, she's just still living that life that she wanted to live and that her dad lived. Okay, so then I found a picture of her dad, which we'll post, and then people commenting on it just like, oh, he was taken from us too soon. How much they love him. Okay, then I did a little more digging and found that there is an annual endurance ride in honor of Bill Thornburg. Oh. And so this is an endurance ride with horses. And then I found a Facebook post a little bit more about Bill that I thought I'd read and just why this ride was organized in his name. So it says, what loving father can resist comforting his young daughter's desire to ride her horse 100 miles through the Sierra Nevada? This is how Bill Thornburg was first introduced to the sport of endurance in 1969. His daughter, Callie, sent in her Tevis entry and received a letter back saying that it could not be accepted because she was too young. She needed a sponsor to ride with that was over the age of 21. After showing the letter to her dad, he said if she got a horse ready for him, he would be her sponsor. Mm-hmm. Callie conditioned two horses by riding one and ponying the other all winter and spring in preparation for the big ride. The summer of 1969, father and daughter started Tevis for the first time. I don't know if I'm saying that right. Unfortunately for Callie, her horse was pulled at Michigan Bluff for lameness.
Oh, no.
Bill went on to finish the ride without her and finished in 38th place. Mm. The next morning, Bill was so sore he couldn't move. According to Callie, he said even his hair hurt. He had big bruises where the buttons on his western shirt had hit him all day.
Oh my God.
The next year, Bill conditioned his own horse. He and Callie were able to finish the ride together in 79th and 80th place.
God, that's Bill, so nice.
Oh my God. Like, they must have been so close. Yeah. It's so sad. Bill began going to endurance rides with his daughters, Callie and Tracy. He converted an old school bus into a motorhome so he and his girls could travel to rides in comfort. Prior to endurance, Bill didn't have any hobbies. He just worked a lot. He was a rancher raising cattle and growing hay. He loved the sport of endurance and especially loved riding with his family. He was very encouraging of families to ride together. It was common to see him riding with other junior riders who were in need of a sponsor. Oh! At one ride, he acquired several juniors throughout the day, earning him the nickname Papa Duck.
Oh my God, too nice. I can't.
Early on in the sport of endurance, there were many more juniors on the trail than we see today. This is from 2017. Bill was a very social person and loved walking around camp talking with everyone. He was a man known to be of sound moral character and deep inner strength. People loved to talk with him to experience his wisdom. In 1976, Bill had his best season riding his favorite horse, Nova's Blue Blood, a three-quarter Arabian. They completed 810 miles. The endurance world, the Lone Pine community, and especially his family lost Bill Thornburg much too soon. He may have only rode a total of 1,865 career miles, but his impact on the people's lives he touched could not be measured. Oh. Those that knew Bill will never forget him, and those that didn't have missed sharing his abundance of wisdom and his way of life.
Oh my gosh.
Oh my gosh. So it's just so sad. Wait till you see the pictures of this guy. He's like a handsome cowboy, and it's just horrible, horrible. We hate Steve Wilson, wherever you are.
Oh my gosh, I'm looking at the picture.
So that's the story of Bill Thornburg, and I am so glad to see that Callie is doing well despite the circumstances, and I think she's amazing, and honestly so beautiful.
You know, I'm a huge reader, but the last few months I've had a hard time finding the time to sit down with a good book. Between my full-time job, this podcast, my family, and the general absurdity of life these days, I don't get to just sit and read anymore, which is why Audible is so great. With an audiobook, I can enjoy my favorite titles while still getting other stuff done. Audible is the leading provider of spoken word entertainment, all in one place. At Audible, you can find the largest selection of audiobooks, ranging from bestsellers and new releases to celebrity memoirs, languages, business, motivation, and more, like original entertainment from top celebrity creators and thousands of popular and binge-worthy podcasts. I have to say, Audible has so many true crime books available that I've loved. Titles like I'll Be Gone in the Dark by Michelle McNamara, which was awesome, and The Stranger Beside Me by the OG of true crime writing, Anne Rule, along with so many others. As an Audible member, you'll get one credit every month good for any title in their entire premium selection. That means the latest bestseller, the buzziest new release, or that bucket list title that you've been meaning to pick up. Those titles are yours to keep forever in your Audible library. You'll also get full access to their popular Plus catalog. It's filled with thousands and thousands of audiobooks, original entertainment, guided fitness and meditation, and podcasts, including ad-free versions of your favorite shows and exclusive series. All of them are included with your membership, so you can download and stream all you want. No credits needed. You can always find the perfect title for whatever you're doing or whatever you're feeling. You can even squeeze in a workout or guided meditation without having to go to a gym or a class. The best part? New members can try Audible for free for 30 days on us. Visit audible.com/resolved or text resolved to 500-500. That's audible.com/resolved, R-E-S-O-L-V-E-D, or text resolved to 500-500.
So this is a lost loves about Frank Bloomer, Frank or Frankie Bloomer. And I don't think I've had one of these since season one, honestly.
Oh, really?
I don't know. Maybe. It's been a long time.
Wow.
So Stack does one of the most depressing intros of all time by saying that most of the audience is familiar with stories of American soldiers still missing in action in Vietnam. And we've discussed this before, how close Vietnam was to actually the airing of UM.
Yeah.
It's crazy. But he asks us to imagine the pain and anguish of other families who have been carrying that terrible burden since World War II. Mm. Stack says, this is a story of one American sailor's family and their steadfast dream of reunion. Frank Joseph Bloomer was born October 12, 1921 in Ziegler, Illinois. He was the youngest of two sons and loved the outdoors, especially swimming and fishing. At the start of World War II, Frankie enlisted in the Navy, against his parents' wishes. Frankie Bloomer was a radio technician aboard the USS Rowan, a destroyer operating in the Mediterranean Sea. September 11, 1943, off the coast of Italy, a German U-boat targeted the Rowan. The Rowan was hit by a torpedo and it sank within a minute. 202 American sailors were killed. Frankie Bloomer, the 22-year-old radio man first class, was MIA. Dorothy Bloomer, Frank's sister-in-law, says that his parents heard about the Rowan sinking on their car radio.
Oh,
and a little while later, they were informed it was missing in action, which is horrible. Less than a week later, Jane Bloomer saw a photo in the newspaper of three survivors of the USS Rowan. So we'll post the photo, of course, and it is fairly clear because this segment really reminded me of Mark Dennis. Like, it's almost the same exact intro. Like, we have the family seeing this photo of soldiers and being like, that's my soldier. But this one is a lot more clear. Like, the Mark Dennis one was very, like, high contrast.
Shadowy.
Very, shadowy.
Yeah.
And this one's a lot more clear. So this one's more probable to me from the beginning. Anyway, Jane Bloomer recognizes the man in the center of the photo as her son, Frankie. So Jane called Dorothy, her daughter-in-law, to come look at the photo with her. Dorothy comes over and they compare like a photo of Frankie versus this photo. And Dorothy tells us that when she saw the photos compared, she was positive the one man was Frankie. Next, Jane took the photos to a mortician who was an expert in photo identification, which was a little confusing to me because those are not the same job.
Nope. They probably were back then, though.
But yeah, I was wondering about that. I was like, maybe for like crime scene purposes, that would have been part of the training. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
So he takes a look at the photo and he sees the way the man is holding his arm in the photo. And he asked Jane if Frankie had ever broken his arm.
Oh, yeah.
She says that he has. He then determined that the men in the two photos are the same man. Dorothy says that when the man told Jane the photo was of Frankie, it gave her a lot more hope. So she wrote to the Red Cross to see if they could help her, but they said they got all their info from the War Department and that they couldn't find any more info than what she already had. Mrs. Bloomer never gave up hope at finding Frankie, but she passed away in 1971. But the hope of finding Frank lived on in the family. Janie Bloomer, Frankie's niece, is interviewed on UM. She remembers being told about her uncle Frankie at a very young age. Janie says, I would say that my grandmother and grandfather lived with this haunting feeling of never knowing if he was alive or dead until the day they died. Which is always what's so heartbreaking about these MIA stories.
Yeah.
Like, these people just may never have closure.
Yep.
Yeah.
So Janie remembers how her grandparents would celebrate Frankie's birthday every year. Janie says, I'm searching to find the answer, whether he is alive or dead, so that I don't end up the way my grandparents did, because they both died not knowing the real truth of whether he was alive or dead. Stack says that 12 years ago, Janie's parents erected a memorial headstone for Frankie. Janie says she goes to the grave, and it's strange to look at the marker and know that her uncle Frankie is not there. It's weird to think that he could be walking a street somewhere, and there's a marker there with his name on it.
Oh, yeah.
So we do get a little one-sentence update. So the extra details on this story are pretty limited. After the story aired, Unsolved Mysteries received a letter from USS Rowan survivor Wayne Easterling. Wayne Easterling was a pastor in Mount Zion, Illinois. So these quotes I'm pulling are not from his letter. They're from an interview he did with the Herald and Review newspaper in 1995.
Okay.
So it says, quote, "The story on Unsolved Mysteries TV show is about a sailor called Frank Bloomer," says Wayne, 76. "His ship was torpedoed and blown up in World War II, but his family thinks he survived. Sadly, he did not, and I know this because I was a sailor on that ship." "Years ago, I was contacted by a member of the family from Belleville, and I did tell them there wasn't any hope. When this UM segment re-aired in the 90s, Wayne's wife saw it." According to the article, she's sitting there watching TV, and suddenly a photo of her husband with a bloody face comes on the screen. So he's in that photo that they show on UM.
Oh.
And she's like, whoa, so it really catches her attention. So the story and the photo resurfaces, and Wayne, being in the photo, knew who the two other men in the photo were.
Sure.
Quote, "That sailor was Richard Hennessy, a friend of mine who died in 1974. The other man is Chris Harvey, whose eyes were burned out. He's now a blind attorney in Decatur, Georgia."
My God.
What?
What?
Whoa.
So Wayne called UM immediately and was like, "Hey, I'm in the photo and I know who the other two people are."
Wow.
None of them are Frankie Bloomer. So just a little more from Wayne about his experience on the Rowan that day. Quote, "It was 1 a.m. in the Mediterranean Sea. We exploded and sank within a minute. Out of 276 crew, just 68 survived."
Wow.
So apparently he had gotten this head wound and he was super groggy and he like couldn't even really swim. He was just kind of like delusionally floating, and he bumped into a life raft.
Whoa.
As he was floating there. And that's like the reason he's alive.
Wow.
He said in the 1995 interview that he used to have nightmares, but they had finally faded, but that he'd sometimes have weird flashbacks. Quote, "I'll be out driving and suddenly hear that explosion again," he said. "It's a funny thing."
Mm.
And of course, we now know that is PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
So according to fandom, the Bloomers, along with the Navy, now accept that Frankie died during the attack on USS Rowan.
Wow.
And that's it.
Wow. Like, at least they were able to receive closure.
Totally.
Right?
Yeah. And this one was like so much more just cut and dry.
Yeah.
Then like Mark Dennis, for example, like this family wasn't necessarily obsessing over it. They were just like, that looks like him. We think he could be alive. And then somebody said, hey,
I was
these
there.
Are the people in the photo and it's not him. And they were like, all right.
Okay. Yeah.
So, yeah. Mm. So that's it.
Freaky. So sad.
Went down with the ship and the family did get to know that eventually.
Yeah. The last segment of season 3, episode 17, is a missing person segment, and it's the story of Judy Himes. Stack starts out by saying that, Stack starts out by saying that for a young woman to be pregnant and unmarried is nearly always a disturbing and unsettling prospect.
Not good.
He did say that.
I know. But we love him, and that was then, and this is now, and 1.5 million unmarried women had a baby in 2018.
So all right.
Tell that to them. In 1965, Judith Himes, a 22-year-old medical technician from Coral Gables, Florida, found herself in that difficult position. With nowhere to turn, Judith decided to have an illegal abortion. It was a decision that probably led to her disappearance and quite possibly her death.
Aww.
Judith Himes learned that she was pregnant in August of 1965. The name she gave for her pregnancy test was B. Kenny, evidence that she may have been trying to keep her condition a secret. I have also seen it spelled as B. Kini, K-I-N-I, or B. Bikini, K-E-E-N-I, which I'm sorry, has to be a play on bikini.
It has to be.
Oh my God.
There's a joke there somewhere.
Yeah.
She had jokes and none of us get it, but that was definitely intentional. That can't be an accident.
Totally.
Judy's friend, Marilyn Jackson, is interviewed and said that Judy never said anything to her about the fact that she might have been pregnant. Marilyn says that Judy called her the day she was going to have the abortion to say that she was leaving work early and going shopping. The day she disappeared, Judith went to the bank and withdrew $300. Judith told her friends that she was going to buy a watch. Police believe that instead, Judith used the money for the abortion. Detective Sergeant Bob Robkin of the Coral Gables Police Department says that they were able to learn that Judy had contacted a friend of hers who was able to arrange an abortion with the suspect, Dr. George Hoju. A date, time, and price was set, and Judith made arrangements to get the money. And the last time she was seen, police believe that she was on her way to get the abortion. Stack tells us that George Hoju was a Hungarian immigrant who posed as an accredited physician. So fucking gross. According to police, Hoju operated an illegal abortion clinic in Coral Gables. Marilyn Jackson says that Judy didn't have any other choice than to have the abortion because in those days, no woman would have a child alone and keep it. It just wasn't done. Not in the, quote, group that she was friendly with. Marilyn says that people have said that Judy died having the abortion, but Marilyn says that Judith was a lab technician and she had a lot of medical knowledge, so Marilyn finds it hard to believe that Judy could have died having an abortion. Marilyn claims that Judy was intelligent enough to go for help someplace. This reasoning just does not flesh out. I mean, one doesn't have anything to do with the other. Judith was probably scared. She was probably under a local anesthetic. So I don't think she would have been able to assist in her own procedure. No. Or even really knew what was going on at
I
the
know.
Time.
I thought that was ridiculous.
Yeah, I know. Also saying that she would have known to go someplace for help implies that she walked out of that clinic, which I don't think she did. Mm-mm. Stack says that Judith Hines disappeared on September 14th, 1965. 3 weeks later, a rental car registered in her name was found 650 miles away in Atlanta, Georgia. On the back seat were traces of blood. Detective Robkin says that unfortunately the car had sat there for 2 or 3 days before it was found, and by the time they were able to conduct an investigation on it, it had been handled by other police agencies. By the time it got back to Dade County to be processed, whatever crime scene that existed was totally ruined. Oh. Because this was back before chain of custody, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
A local resident had spotted a man in his 30s parking the vehicle. He removed what appeared to be a duffel bag from the trunk and then left the area. The man has never been identified. 3 months later, George Hoju was arrested for impersonating a physician. He jumped bail and has not been seen since. Perjury charges against him are still on the books, and police speculate he may know what happened to Judith Hines. Shortly after Hoju's escape, police ended their investigation into Judith's disappearance. Stack says Judith Hines' case soon faded from local memory, but 25 years later, the investigation would be reopened thanks to a bizarre series of events that began with a police narcotics lecture in Nebraska. This is like another one of those segments where you think it's over and then it's like, whoops, mm-hmm. Nope,
yeah.
total B storyline. Stack says that Captain Chuck Shearer of the Coral Gables Police Department was unfamiliar with the Hines case. In 1990, Shearer had a speaking engagement at a police academy 200 miles west of Omaha, Nebraska. The lecture itself was uneventful, and Shearer returned home. It was then that he received a phone call from the past. 2 days after the Nebraska lecture, Captain Shearer received a long-distance phone call at his office in Coral Gables. The caller identified himself as Steve Brown, the host of a popular radio talk show in Omaha. He said an anonymous caller had given him information on the disappearance of Judith Hines. Captain Shearer told Brown that he wasn't familiar with the case and that he would have to get back to him. Shearer asked Brown if he could give him some contact information for the anonymous caller, and Brown gave him 2 phone numbers. So then, this totally zags. Steve Brown is then interviewed, and he says that a man called him and said that he had information that he was looking for. Steve Brown replies to the man he had no idea what he was talking about. Captain Shearer says that Steve Brown was totally surprised to hear from him. Brown said he had never heard of him, didn't know anything about what Shearer was talking about, and denied adamantly that he was the one who made the phone calls. Shearer was able to give Brown his own unlisted phone number, and Brown says he began to think through the people that have the number and if they could have called, but no one came to mind that would make that phone call without telling Brown and claiming to be him. This is from a news article I read. Quote, that really puzzled me, said Brown. I guess maybe 50 people have that number, but I have no idea who made that call to Captain Shearer. I don't know anything about the case, and I'm pretty mystified. Captain Shearer says that now he's confused, and he doesn't know what to think. Why would a 25-year-old case surface all of a sudden out of Omaha, Nebraska, when Shearer had never been to Omaha prior to going to give the lecture? Also, Shearer says he didn't have any knowledge about the case and had never mentioned the case to anyone in Omaha because he didn't know it existed. 2 days after he contacted the real Steve Brown, Captain Scheer received another unusual phone call. A woman called and said, "Judy Himes is alive and she lives in Omaha. Judy Himes is alive and she lives in Omaha." And then she hangs up. Scheer says that his gut feeling is that something is going on to bring this case back up 25 years later, and it's very possible that Judy is in fact living in the Omaha area. In the fall of 1989, an article on the Himes case appeared in a local newspaper. Captain Scheer then received yet another anonymous phone call. Scheer says the third phone call he received was from a man who identified himself as an informant for the FBI. The man refused to give his name, but he said that he had just spent several weeks with Hoju in Budapest, Hungary, and he gave him a phone number. Scheer contacted Interpol, and they were able to confirm that the phone number did belong to Hoju. Stack says the police have, quote, yet to contact Hoju in Hungary, but they believe that he wasn't responsible for the phone calls. So a bunch of people online were like, why wouldn't they track Hoju down, and why did nothing come of this? The U.S. didn't sign an extradition with Hungary until 1994, and it took effect in 1997. So at the time they received the information, they could probably do nothing with it because they couldn't compel Hungary to work with them.
Yeah.
Police have searched the Omaha area and have found no trace of Judy Himes. Stack asked, who placed the anonymous phone calls? And if they are telling the truth, where is Judith Himes today? Did she have an abortion and die as a result, or did she just disappear? Scheer says that maybe she didn't want the family to find out about the abortion and chose to disappear. Marilyn Jackson says she'd like to believe that she's someplace. She says it's hard to believe that she could be dead, but that if she's alive, how could she go so long without contacting somebody after all this time? Marilyn says, after all, there are no more stigmas. After all, there are no more stigmas left. Why wouldn't she come back?
It's a miracle.
Marilyn. Honey. There's many a stigma to be had here. But I do believe that Jackson's talking about abortion being legalized in 73. So I think that's what she means. Let's not get it twisted. It's legal, but there's still a lot of stigma attached.
Yeah.
Then the show has an update. It says that 4 days after the broadcast, an unsigned letter arrived at the Coral Gables Police Department. The letter stated that Judith Himes died from complications during an illegal abortion. The letter revealed that Judith's body had been dumped in Biscayne Bay near Miami. Although her body was never found, police do believe that the letter is legitimate. So, this is a super sad story. This death didn't need to happen.
Yeah.
I started researching illegal abortion and just got so aggravated and upset that I stopped. Mm-hmm. But according to the WHO and the Guttmacher Institute that did a study as recently as 2018, at least 22,800 women die annually as a result of complications of unsafe abortion.
Oh my God.
And between 2 million and 7 million women each year survive unsafe abortions but sustain long-term damage or diseases. Hmm. Suffice to say, women should have the ability to choose between having a child they don't want and possibly dying.
Oh. Yeah.
And I'll stop there. So, by 1965, the year Judy died of her botched abortion, the number of deaths due to illegal abortion had fallen to just under 200 a year in the United States. But illegal abortions still accounted for 17% of all deaths attributed to pregnancy and childbirth that year. And these are just the numbers that were officially reported. The actual number is likely much higher.
Yeah.
Judy was a 22-year-old divorcee. She had been married to a man named Robert Bellamy, who she had only been divorced from for a few months at the time of her murder. She worked as a lab technician at University of Miami Medical School at Jackson Memorial Hospital. Himes was last seen by her mother as she headed to Jackson Memorial Hospital to go to work. She was wearing a white hospital uniform. The fact that she was pregnant was discovered after a lab test receipt was found among her personal effects at the home of her parents, who she was staying with after the divorce. So I feel like if they did not find that receipt, people would know even less about her disappearance.
Yes.
Judith was described as quiet and sheltered. She was from a very wealthy family. Her father was a real estate developer. And Judith had recently gotten a large settlement from her divorce. She had recently deposited $25,000 into a Los Angeles bank account, but the money was never touched. 7 years later, when she was declared dead, the money was turned over to her family. So Judy used the false name B. Keeney for the pregnancy test, but she was recognized by a girl who went to the technician school with her.
Mm.
When Judy was asked by the laboratory for the name of her doctor to whom results could be mailed, investigators found she gave a dentist's name and office address. Lab records show that the pregnancy test was positive. So Judith took the $300 out of the bank, but she did actually buy a very expensive watch. It was delivered to her home the day after she went missing. It's crazy to me that she would have paid $300 for an abortion. It's almost $2,500 today, which is just a crazy amount of money. But I didn't know that these illegal abortions, you would have to pay that much money.
Yeah, I didn't either.
It's so much money. So Judy had a rental car that was later found abandoned because her own car had been damaged by Hurricane Betsy. At the time, Hurricane Betsy was the costliest hurricane in the history of the United States and the first hurricane to cause over $1 billion in damages. There are two reports of men around her car, and for a while, everyone thought they were the same report. There was one report that the man was in his 30s, grabbed a duffel bag, and walked away from the car. But then there was another report that a man around 20 years old with a bad complexion and a crew cut was seen with a dark-haired girl. So for a while, they thought maybe the dark-haired girl was Judy. Mm-hmm. But it turns out a witness misidentified this 20-year-old man and this 30-year-old man as the same person. So it turns out that the two people that were by the car heard that the car had been involved in possibly a murder and like kind of were looky-loos and went to check the car out. Mm. So they were the couple that was near the car that people thought might have been Judy. It was not her. And then I read an article from February of 1966 that said police were looking for a man going by the name Smith, who was the one who dropped off her car in Atlanta and then possibly flew back to Miami. Investigators found flight records which showed that someone using the name Smith had paid cash for a flight from Atlanta to Miami shortly after the car was dropped off, but they were unable to track this person down. Clearly, Smith is probably an alias. Mm-hmm. Dr. Lucian Gordon, a dentist, was identified as the man whom Judy dated prior to her disappearance. He is believed to be her child's father. A few days before she vanished, he went with Judy to meet Dr. Hojo. Another doctor, Herschel Gordon, no relation to Lucian Gordon, was identified as the man who referred Judy to Hojo. It is not known if either was involved in Judy's disappearance. Lucian Gordon and Herschel Gordon were brought in by state's attorney Richard Gerson in October of 1965, but neither would cooperate. A newspaper article I read reported that the police believed that the three, quote, Miami professional men knew more than they were saying. Hmm. Basically, it's Lucian Gordon and Herschel Gordon. Lucian was the dentist and her boyfriend. Herschel Gordon was a doctor that Lucian was friends with. One of them had a representative call this attorney, Daniel Sepler. They were like, I have a friend whose girlfriend disappeared. She was possibly getting an illegal abortion, but he can't be connected because he's a medical professional. So do we tell law enforcement? How do we go about getting this information out without this person basically being culpable? Mm-hmm. So Sepler is giving all of these hypotheticals. So the police basically arrest him because he won't say who these people are. Mm-hmm. And they bring him in front of a judge, and the judge puts him in contempt and sends him to jail for 10 days.
Wow.
So eventually, the names were released, and the state attorney got Dr. Herschel Gordon involved. He was not cooperative, and then he moved to Santa Ana, California right after, so he just latered. Then they went to Lucian Gordon, the boyfriend, but he refused to cooperate. Lucian Gordon just passed away in June of 2020. Herschel Gordon is in his late 80s, and I believe he is still a pathologist out in California. And I found the most amazing promotional photo of him on a website. It's like one of those 1980s portraits where there's a person doing something and then their face behind them hovering.
Yes, honey, I know.
So it's Herschel, presumably, on a microscope and then his head hovering. So that's where they ended up. And then as far as the calls that were coming in, everyone was like, but what about the call? This is a crazy coincidence. Another Sitcoms Online poster, I think it was The Cars 1987. This person pointed out that they had read that either a newspaper or a magazine article had been written about cold missing person cases, including Judith Hines, around that time. And it had been nationally distributed prior to Scheer's lecture in Omaha. This commenter goes on to say, it's possible someone in Omaha who read the article called Shearer in Florida with the information because they knew he was connected to the same police department that investigated the Himes case back in the 1960s. So maybe someone actually thought they saw Judy Himes, or maybe it was a hoax, or maybe they were trying to get the case reopened and thought using a radio host name would be more legitimate. The actual letter that came in a few days after the broadcast read, quote, Judy Himes is not alive. She came in for an abortion and was given an injection of anesthetic to which she had an immediate allergic reaction. Everything that could be done was done. However, the reaction was fatal. The body was disposed of in Biscayne Bay. In the reenactment, there were at least two other women who appeared to have worked in Dr. Hoju's office. It looks like there was at least a nurse and a receptionist. I assumed that one of these women must have wrote the letter. And then someone on Sitcoms Online, the user TiddlyWonks950, posted that in 2007, they had spoken to Marilyn Jackson, Judy's friend who was featured on UM, and she had said that the letter was legitimate and written by a nurse who was there that day. She said that the woman eventually came forward and talked to the police and that they closed the case and declared Judith Himes legally dead. So then, another Sitcoms Online poster, Meg the Egg 86, who we hear from a lot, she was able to dig up the name of a woman who was questioned about the Himes' death around the same time that Dr. Hoju was. And the woman's name, I'm not going to give her full name, but her first name is Donna. And she ended up moving to Sioux City, Iowa, which is only about 90 miles from Omaha, Nebraska. So I found this woman, Donna, and I reached out to her. Obviously, she has not gotten back to me. But I think it's entirely possible that maybe she was the one that made that Judy Himes is alive in Omaha call.
God, yeah.
And she could have been the one that sent the note.
Jeez.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe she was there that day and wanted to give people peace of mind, but also didn't want to implicate herself, you know?
Wow.
And that's it. That's all I got on this.
Wow.
Everyone was saying, too, like, I doubt that she died under anesthesia. That's sort of an excuse to make, like, no one's fault.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was blood in the backseat of the car.
Right. Oh.
I don't think that the doctor, the dentist were actively involved. I think they just tried to save their asses afterwards. But yeah, sad story. Didn't need to happen. Legalize abortion everywhere.
Seriously.
Get it together. And that's it.
Good job. Okay. I will go. I have never seen Search Party, and so we just binged the first two seasons.
So good, right?
Oh my gosh.
I don't know what it is.
Oh, it's so good.
You would love it. You gotta watch it. And then I also just want to say that Lady Gaga's Joanne album is so good.
Is it?
And I know I'm very late to this game, but
I've never heard it, so you're not later than me.
Angel Down, Joanne, and Million Reasons are like three of my favorite songs right now, and they're all on that album. And so,
hey,
I recommend. It's a very different Lady Gaga album.
Sweet.
Not her normal. That's Katie? It for me.
My partner and I started watching WandaVision on Disney Plus, and it is so well done. It's so well produced. It's so weird. It's great.
Mm-hmm. It looks so beautiful.
It's gorgeous. The last two episodes that we watched, I think were episode maybe 3 and 4 or 4 and 5. They were these little mini movies. You completely lose yourself in the experience of this one small episode. So when it's over, you're just like, I can't believe they just did that in 30 minutes.
Yeah. And the references to like vintage television are very spot on.
That's the thing, too. If you've ever grew up watching I Love Lucy or
Bewitched
or
Full House,
they just did the 80s yesterday.
So when I just watched with
Jerry. Yeah, it was like a very Growing Pains introduction, like painting the watercolor. It's so spot on. It really is. It's just a really clever TV show. All right. What are we talking about next episode? Eliza's so excited. So excited.
Oh, God. Well, you go first. Go ahead.
Okay, so I have the first segment, and it is the unexplained death of Cindy James. You know it. You love it.
Oh.
I'm terrified to cover it.
A few of you have written to us about it.
One of the regular Sitcoms Online posters has that famous photo of her as their profile photo.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a bananas case, so we're going to get into it.
All right, and then segment two is an unexplained segment about Betty Cash.
Don't worry. It's a Legends. Butch Cassidy coming at ya. I'm going to have a good attitude about it. Here we go.
It might be fun. It might be like when I did Billy the Kid. I had a great time.
Yeah.
Remember Brushy Bill?
Classic. Oh, yeah.
Neckerchief, nips.
How could we forget?
It's going to be great. We get the best quotes out of these, so that's true.
It's true. And then a fourth segment is Lost Loves about Aletha Everts. Okay, everybody. So you can go to patreon.com/resolvemysteriespodcast if you would like to get ad-free eppies, extra eppies, goodies in the mail. You can also see photos of all the funny things we reference in our episodes on Instagram at Resolve Mysteries Podcast. You can hang out with us on Facebook and Twitter at Resolve the Pod. You can contact us at resolvemysteriespodcast.com, resolvemysteriespodcast@gmail.com, our P.O. Box 14005, Portland, Oregon 97293. Also, please send us stories for listener short stack episodes. You can tell us about anything you think would be interesting, anything that's related to the show, or just anything. And subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like us, please leave a 5-star review, tell a friend, and don't forget, for every review we receive, we're donating $1 to GEMS. All right, that's it.
All right, thanks everyone.
Thanks for hanging.
Thanks, guys. Love ya.
Love ya.
Bye.
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 I just did it
as those well. Numbers are going up.
Mine is also recording. And I'm turning off my fucking metronome.
Oh, God. Get it off of there.
The ever-persistent metronome.
Oh, you two crazy people. Okay.
You signed right, up so I'm for gonna... this.
Oh, I did. Full on. I knew exactly what I was getting into with you two. Okay. I'm going to call out the clap. Ready? One, two, three.
That's pretty close. Pretty close.
All right. All right. I'll allow it.